hire attorneys to help us, and that costs money. And if anybody wants to help us, we can sure use that help.
And the website, Citizens Against LNG, will be up again in the near future, right?
Yeah, it's up, but it's not fully up, but it's still up. But yeah, citizensagainstlng.com.
There's a ton of information there. When these hearings and public meetings are going to happen, all of that, how you can get involved, because it's our coastline, all of us. Well, thanks so much for that, Joni McCaffrey, Citizens Against LNG out of Coos Bay. And one note, too, this afternoon, either way, the judge rules, is a landmark civil rights turning point for the state of Oregon. Judge Michael McShane is expected to issue his ruling around noon on whether Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage violates constitutional rights. It's likely Judge McShane will strike the ban down, paving the way for gay couples across Oregon to tie the knot. The people will be out in full force. This is a major civil rights issue of our time. And being at the forefront, leading this... is where Oregon needs to be. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, May 19th, 2014. Joe Clement engineered the show today. Thanks for that, Joe. Kathleen Stevenson, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andring. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Over the last half billion years, there have been five mass extinctions when the diversity of life on Earth suddenly and dramatically contracted. Scientists around the world are currently monitoring the sixth extinction, predicted to be the most devastating extinction event since the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. This morning, we talk with writer Elizabeth Colbert, whose new book, The Sixth Extinction, A Unnatural History, explores how the culprit behind the extinction we are currently witnessing is us. Elizabeth is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her stories for the magazine have included political profiles, book reviews, comment pieces, and extensive writing on climate change. Elizabeth, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
So it's good to have you on this morning, and we can make up for the last time.
Exactly.
And actually, we have like twice as much time to talk today, so I'm actually really happy about that. So I was wondering if this book, which is getting a lot of play, fortunately, and I've actually seen you and heard you on innumerable interview shows, so obviously a lot of people are hearing about the book, and I hope reading it. But it seems that you're best known for writing a lot about climate change and tar sands operations. In fact, I think that your article in The New Yorker about the tar sands up in Alberta was the first that a lot of us had actually heard about it. And I'm wondering if your work on climate change and other environmental disasters that you've been following were fodder for looking at this mass extinction that we find ourselves in the midst of.
Absolutely. You know, I wrote, as you said, a book about climate change. It was a series of pieces in the New Yorker back in 2005, and then it became a book. And I was sort of looking for a sequel to that, to be honest, another book on climate change, and I wanted it to be a more sort of solutions-oriented book, to be honest. But I kept bumping up against, in a way, the sort of opposite point, which is that climate change is really just one of the ways that humans are altering the planet on a really profound level, geological scale, very basically permanent scale, and that's really what led to the most recent book, The Sixth Extinction.
But one of the things that really struck me as I was reading the book was it seems that as bad as climate change and other environmental disasters that we're familiar with are, that perhaps the biggest impact that humans have had on the rest of the biosphere is that our own impact as an invasive species, and then the number of invasive species we've catalyzed to take over the rest of the world. And I wonder if you see it that way, that perhaps that is the ultimate issue, is that, as you say, you describe it when you're... chapters, that we have managed to bring all the continents back together as they were in very prehistoric times.
Well, if you look at the extinctions that we know of that have taken place in sort of what you'd call sort of historical time, let's say, I think it's, you'd say, a majority of them, and an invasive species was probably at least in part responsible. And so I think that quite possibly we are going to find, I mean, it's sort of like a race to the bottom here, or whatever you want to say. We're doing so many things simultaneously to the planet that are really having profound impacts. And when you first began that sentence, I wasn't sure where you were going to end up, to be honest, because you could have also chosen, you know, ocean acidification, which is another way that we're changing the planet in a really, really, you know, very profound and pretty dangerous way. But I think that this idea of sort of reassembling the biosphere, bringing together lineages that have evolved separately over, in many cases, you know, tens of millions of years on separate continents, on islands, and bringing them together, you know, from one day to the next, in some cases, we are finding, you know, what's been known about that really on some level for quite a while now, which is that, you know, that many different things can happen when you bring species that have been apart for a long time together, and they run the spectrum from nothing. You know, the species that you introduce, it's an insect, it's a plant, it's an animal, you nothing happens. That species can't survive in the new place and it just disappears. Two, that species thrives and turns out to be very, very dangerous for other species that are already there. And when you think about it, even if that last case where, you know, the species turns out to be really dangerous as a pathogen, for example, introduced pathogens are a huge, huge problem now, even if that is only happening in a very tiny proportion of the cases, we are moving so many species around the world now. As I report in the book, you know, there's an estimate that 10,000 species a day are being moved around in our ballast water. So if even, you know, 0.01% of those turn out to be really dangerous for other life forms, you know, that can be a very, very huge problem very quickly if you're moving so many species around.
Well, I think one of the reasons why I latched on to the invasive species topic as one of the most alarming for extinctions to me is looking at human beings as an invasive species ourselves,
right,
and which you bring up, and that this goes back, the impact that we've had as an invasive species on the rest of the life forms on the Earth goes back way before industrialization, way before, even before agriculture. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how Homo sapiens, what enabled Homo sapiens to spread beyond the initial continent that they were on and to take over the rest of the world.
Yeah, that is at the heart of the matter. I agree with you. I mean, and that question is an open question. You know, it's not something that I can give a simple answer to. But if you just look at
at human history. Let's just look at human history for a moment. So humans evolved, you know, in one place, as all creatures do. We almost certainly evolved in Africa, probably in East Africa. And then, you know, we didn't do much for a while. We sat in Africa. By some accounts, the population of modern, what are called, you know, anatomically modern humans might have reached a very, very low number at a certain point around 75,000 years ago. That's one theory. I just don't, you know, we just don't know the answer to that. But anyway, we and then some of our, you know, distant ancestors of the people who would then populate all the other continents left Africa. And, you know, as soon as we did that, we started to encounter, first of all, one really interesting thing that is a pretty new revelation of science is that we started to encounter other, you know, hominids, so other humans, basically, but they weren't quite exactly like us, and they're no longer with us. And the question of why they're no longer with us, you know, is a mystery, but it seems to fit a pattern that wherever we went, we did them in somehow. Either we outcompeted them, or we, you know, actively did them in because they were different, or we absorbed them. That's another possibility. So Neanderthals are the classic example. Humans got to, anatomically modern humans got to Europe around, let's say, around 40,000 years ago. They encountered Neanderthals who had themselves probably evolved from a common ancestor that we share with Neanderthals, which is not that long ago, maybe 500,000 years ago. But they'd evolved in Europe. And when we encountered Neanderthals, two things happened. First of all, we now know from genetic analysis that we had sex with them. We interbred with them. Humans interbred with Neanderthals. And people who are of non-African descent today still carry a small proportion of Neanderthal DNA, which is a really fascinating, very new discovery made just in the last few years. But then the Neanderthals are gone. There are no Neanderthals left anymore, except as tiny little bits of DNA in us. So, you know, what happened to them? And it seems increasingly clear that our arrival was their demise. And that happened to other hominid species, other species very much like ourselves. And now we sort of, you know, wonder why we're the only, you know, sort of, you know, quote unquote, you know, intelligent creature out there. Well, one of the reasons is because we did in all the other ones, and that's a pretty, pretty profound and pretty sobering thought.
Actually, it maybe explains a lot of the problems we're having in the world today. This is the DNA we came from.
Yeah.
And then, of course, is what we did to the non-hominids. And
yes, and then I think. Right, potentially even more profoundly, it's hard to say which is more profound in this situation. We got to places where we started hunting. We were very good hunters. Now hominids in general, the Neanderthals were very good hunters too. But we got to places that we're not used to having any hominids around. We got to, you know, Australia remarkably early on. People got to Australia, which is really quite shocking and somewhat mysterious too, how that happened. By around 50,000 years ago, which is really incredible because you had to get over open water. And there are a couple things that seem to, you know, distinguish humans, you know, even from their closest relatives, the Neanderthals, who did not make it over open water. So Neanderthals never expanded beyond where they could move by land. But modern humans did. They figured out a way. Presumably they had, you know, some kind of boat. We don't know what. We've never found any remnants of it that got them all the way to Australia. And once they got to Australia, they found this really amazing fauna of very interesting, you know, beasts, many of them really supersized, these huge wombat-like creatures, huge tortoises with these horns coming out of their heads, huge birds. And those were done in within, you know, relatively short order, let's say, you know, seems like a few thousand years, let's say. And, you know, when you think about it, no one knows exactly how people did them in, but the coincidence of people arriving and all of these very large species disappearing seems to be too much of a coincidence. And it seems that, you know, you reach a place that does not have a predator like humans, and suddenly they're there. Well, those species that are slow to reproduce, just turn out to be extremely vulnerable. They cannot keep up with that hunting pressure, even a very small hunting pressure from a very small number of people, and they're gone eventually. And we see the same pattern happen in North America when humans reach North America much, much later, say 15,000 years ago, and South America. And so we had these huge creatures in North America that, you know, mastodons and mammoths were very, very common in this part of the world, the Northeast where I live. You find a lot of mastodon bones, and they are no longer with us. And why is that? Well, it seems, once again, that it's because of our arrival.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with writer Elizabeth Colbert, whose book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, explores how human beings are probably and most likely the root cause of the greatest mass extinction to be happening on Earth since the dinosaurs disappeared. When you talk about the mastodons and other giant, the megafauna of North America disappearing shortly after the arrival of human beings here, and I know that that's kind of a controversial topic. Might be as controversial in Australia, I'm not sure, but I definitely have heard a lot of arguments against that, and I wanted to at least give a little bit of time for the other side of that argument. You do present it in the book, argument. You do present down your movie. I wanted to give it maybe a little more time to give it on your book, and then I want to know why you're not getting it out. So then I want to know why you're not getting it out.
Well, alternative theories are usually connected to some kind of climate change. So what sort of makes the picture in North America quite complicated is that this time when the mastodons and mammoths and many other very large creatures, these huge sloths that we had in this part of the world went extinct, you know, roughly. Once again, we don't know. It's very difficult to find, you know, the last mastodon bone. But from where you find, you know, the time period where you find relatively common mastodon bones, to, you know, when you find none, you know, let's say it's around, 12,000 years ago. Well, that is a period of very, very rapid climate change, relatively speaking, rapid climate change. Probably we're going to see more rapid climate change owing to what we're doing to the atmosphere. But that was the end of the last ice age. You were getting, you know, the ice sheets retreating and the flora of North America changing in many places from a kind of, you know, treeless sort of steppe situation to forest. And so there's always been a lot of thought, well, you know, they didn't have any food. You know, what could they do? But, you know, so that's a, you know, problem when you're thinking about North America. But and the same argument is used for other places. So it is also used for Australia, as you point out, that it was some kind of climate change. But when you think about it, you know, what you'd want for any kind of explanation is, okay, well, climate change, you know, if it were climate change, if it were severe climate change, well, then, you know, A, you'd have to find signs that at that period when there was a spasm of extinction, you were experiencing severe climate change. That is very difficult to do in the case of Australia. It happened about, you know, 25,000 years earlier than in North America, and it was not a time of particularly dramatic climate change either in Australia or anywhere else. So that's very difficult to get it to line up. And then when you look at, okay, well, what does line up? Why are we getting these spasms of extinction in different places at different times? And you find that, lo and behold, that order of extinction waves exactly correlates to what we know about the order in which humans settled a new place, then you really have to, you know, sort of scratch your head just on the basis of that and say, well, the most economical, you know, explanation certainly seems to be the arrival of people. And it's when you look at things, you know, from a pretty simple and stark perspective that humans really emerge as a very obvious culprit. Now, when we also go look at things, now people have these really sophisticated techniques. So one of the experiments that I discuss in Australia looks at the order of events by analyzing this interesting fungus. You get these little spores of fungus in the poop of herbivores, and they actually, you can sort of see when there were a lot of these big herbivores around by looking at cores. You drill a core in a lake, you pull up, you know, mud from 50,000 years ago, and you literally count, you know, how many spores are in there. And you can also find a lot from these lake cores. You see when there was fire, you can get pollen out of them, you see what the vegetation was like. And when you look at these very sophisticated studies, what you find is that the order also doesn't line up. So, for example, you get a shift in the spores start to decline, you know, before you get a change in vegetation. So it's very difficult to say, okay, well, these animals had nothing to eat, because that's not what we're seeing in these lake core records.
I wanted to talk about, get more into the whole concept of extinction, which is something that you spent a lot more time in the book than I was expecting, and it was really a pleasant surprise to learn a whole lot about the history of our understanding of extinction. But I know from myself and probably a whole lot of people, at least my generation and a little older, that we learned about extinction because of the dinosaurs. And that was the first species or range of animals that I ever knew went extinct, and later on learned that there were a whole lot of other animals that went extinct. But I wonder if we could talk about the concept of extinction and why it was so hard for humans to accept that it could happen.
Yeah, it is a really interesting story. Well, this is, you have to put yourself back about only about 200 years ago, a little bit more than 200 years ago. So it's sort of colonial days in America. And prior to that, we're talking mainly about the Europeans sitting there, you know, pondering the natural world, about which they're getting more and more information because they have more and more people out there, you know, colonizing new places, bringing back samples from all around the world. They're very, very interested, you know, when they go to a new place, where they're, looking for all sorts of resources to exploit, but they're also very interested in the flora and fauna that they find in these fantastic new places. And they're sitting there, and the prevailing view is very much, based on a sort of, intersection of faith and an observation, is that everything that exists, has existed. It was created by the Creator, and why would He create something that He's just going to, do away with? So it's this idea of sort of the great chain of being, and humans are, that's sort of at the top of this, and everything else is below us. But everything has been around since it was created, and they keep getting evidence in the form of fossils that have, that are very, very difficult to reconcile with this view, but somehow they manage to do it. They sort of shoehorn that into this view that it must be around. And this view, persisted until Thomas Jefferson, really, was sort of a key figure here, too. He was very interested in fossils. He displayed them in a sort of little museum he had at the White House when he was president. And he also thought that whatever had been created was still out there, and he expected Lewis and Clark, when he sent them out, he was really hoping they'd find a mastodon, because mastodon bones by that point were pretty, they were pretty well known at that point. A lot of them had been shipped back to Europe already. And what happened was a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier, who was really a towering, towering figure of his time, somewhat forgotten now, very much forgotten now, I guess I'd say, came along, and he made a pretty simple point. It wasn't really based on a lot of experimental science. It was based on just, sort of common sense, you could argue. And his point was, and it was especially based on the mastodon. Look, a mastodon was a really, really big animal. We have now explored most parts of North America. And if this animal were out there, we would have either seen it, or we certainly would have heard tales of people who had seen it. It's just not there. It's extinct. And that was the first time, really, that the notion of extinction was raised. And it was accepted, actually, remarkably quickly. It made sense of a lot of really perplexing things that people had found, and the concept of extinction was pretty widely accepted within a couple of decades.
Well, there's still actually some people who deny extinction, and they deny that these animals actually existed. I mean, I think they're on the fringes, but I had the pleasure of visiting the Museum of Creation Science east of San Diego a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And beside my favorite exhibit, which was the Mount St. Helens exhibit, which proved that God created the world in 6 days, because all these changes that happened so fast after Mount St. Helens blew up and nature came back and restored itself so quickly, which is a whole other thing. But it's like, and that gets us to the catastrophic versus the gradualist kind of views in geology and in biology and stuff. And it seems like that was one of the debates that was going on, was that there are those who had a very hard, there were scientists who were, you know, had the age of reason and everything had to be rational. And so you did not have these kind of what they conceived of as divine interventions, where something would change dramatically. And yet there have been cases over and over again where scientists are discovering that there were dramatic changes, which gets me to my favorite story in a way in your book, which is the extinction of the dinosaurs. And
yeah, I mean, the history of thinking about extinction very, very quickly became tied in with this debate over whether the world was capable, whether the world, how does change occur in the world, let's put it that way. And Cuvier, who I mentioned a minute ago, he was of the opinion, he took, once again, what seems like a commonsensical approach, that animals, you know, you see them, they're perfectly adapted, really, to their circumstances, whatever those circumstances are, and the only way you could drive them extinct is if their circumstances change. So the world would have to change very dramatically. That would be the only way to get these extinctions. And he thought that all extinctions took place in these sort of cataclysmic waves. The world changed. He had a very sort of wonderfully, he was quite a good writer, and he had some wonderfully sort of what we would consider very flowery language to describe this. He said the thread of operations is broken. But he was completely opposed to evolution, and this is why he is sort of left on the, you know, dustbin of scientific history. When the history of science is written, he is not given a very prominent place, because he resisted one of his colleagues in Paris, Lamarck, who was one of the very first people to put forward a somewhat also mystical account of evolution. It was not scientifically correct, but he was getting at something that species did change over time, and Cuvier just thought he was sort of a twit, basically, and really was very pretty nasty to him. And so he is sort of accused of having held back even, you know, evolutionary science in France. And then Darwin comes along and says, and not only, you know, sort of comes up with his theory of natural selection, but the flip side of it, he says, is that extinction is something that occurs actually only very, very slowly and very, very much as an individual thing. And new species evolves and it outcompetes a species that's been around, and that species eventually disappears. It's very slow. It's very impossible to see, and it is only occurring in these sort of isolated instances. And so Darwin is such a dominant figure, obviously, and he's correct on so many issues that he really, he sort of sweeps everything else away, and this notion that the world sometimes experiences cataclysms becomes almost an embarrassment. It's something that you cannot even really discuss in scientific circles, because it's to be sort of labeled a quack. And then, and this becomes a problem, actually, the more people learn about the fossil record, because Darwin is depending on this idea that where you see these big breaks in the fossil record, which were already apparent back in the 1850s, that just means there was a lot of time missing from the record, right? So we see what seems to be a big change in the way the world, in the creatures on the planet. That just means that there's millions of years missing in the fossil record, nothing to get excited about. But the more people know about the fossil record, the weirder that explanation becomes, because, you know, why would that period of time, always that same period of time, you know, be missing, like right around when the dinosaurs disappeared, for example? And then in 1980, owing to, and the way science often happens, you know, owing to, in some sense, a series of flukes, a scientist named Walter Alvarez
and his father, Luis Alvarez, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, actually, they come to this theory that, in fact, an asteroid impact is what has killed off the dinosaurs, and not just the dinosaurs, but slews of other groups of organisms. The dinosaurs always get top billing, but, you know, the pterosaurs went out at that moment, the ammonites went out, a lot of birds, a lot of mammals, a lot of everything, a lot of reptiles, everything was really devastated by this extinction event. And that is poo-pooed, you know, because it does not fit in with this gradualist view of the world. But eventually, the evidence is so overwhelming, and the crater that was formed by said asteroid is discovered off the Yucatan Peninsula, and now it is very widely accepted that the dinosaurs and all these other creatures were done in by an asteroid impact. And these other previous mass extinctions also appear to have been relatively quick, caused by, you know, forces. In some cases, we're not sure exactly what. But this idea that the Earth changes only very slowly is true most of the time, but sometimes it is not. Sometimes it changes very quickly. And one of the, you know, points of the book is that right now we are in one of those moments, and all it doesn't look to us very quick, you know, because we have a limited lifespan. But in a geological sense, what we are doing to the planet is very, very dramatic and very, very rapid, not unlike an asteroid.
Well, actually, I find the asteroid theory, I just remember when I first started hearing about this asteroid that it wiped out the dinosaurs, and I think that that theory was going on, what, in the 70s, maybe? And
it's first proposed in 1980 in a very famous paper in Science.
So, and it just sounded to me like total crackpot, and I just never took it seriously. And then I was actually reading a National Geographic, the bulk work of scientific evidence, and they were talking about the Yucatan crater, and there was all this evidence that the asteroid had killed the dinosaurs. And it was kind of like this light bulb went on in my head of, this is amazing. It's something that I thought was completely science fiction turns out to be fact. It's that kind of shift in thinking. How does that maybe help us to look at what we're doing right now and be able to accept that something that we really don't want to believe in or just seems too far-fetched might actually be right in front of our eyes and something that we really have to grapple with?
Yeah, I think you're identifying a really, you know, important point, because I think we do have a lot of trouble acknowledging or thinking that, you know, that things can, the world can change very quickly. We're all still living in this, you know, Darwinian world, and thinking, well, you know, the world is a big place, and yes, humans are very, very, you know, smart, and they're very powerful, and clearly we're changing a lot of the world, but, you know, how big a deal can this really be? And, you know, one of the really, to me, the most sort of sobering part of writing the book was looking at, you know, people are going back and looking, trying to figure out in these five previous mass extinctions of the last half a billion years, okay, what went on? And the worst of these mass extinctions was actually not the end Cretaceous extinction, which did in the dinosaurs and their compatriots, but what's known as the end Permian extinction, which occurred about 250 million years ago, and which came perilously close to just, you know, wiping out multicellular life. There's a pretty famous book on the extinction called When Life Nearly Died. So it was a really dreadful event, and people are looking at that very carefully right now, because it seems that the what precipitated that was a very, very massive release of carbon dioxide, which caused global temperatures to soar, which caused the oceans to become acidified, and also to become anoxic, so not to have any oxygen. And when they go back and look at that and try to sort of calculate, okay, what, how much CO2 is released and at what rate, the best guesses, the best estimates that people have been able to come up with are they, CO2 is being released at a rate that is, you know, slower than what we are doing right now. So, well, the things that we consider to be really, really ordinary, which is driving around and, you know, having these power plants that convert coal into electricity, those are on a geological scale, and the whole history of life on the planet really extraordinary events. And I think getting our minds around that is very, very difficult for us.
Do they have any idea what caused the carbon dioxide releases at the end Permian extinction?
Well, the best theory that people have come up with, and I think it's pretty widely accepted, and there seems to be increasingly good evidence for this, is that it was one of these very unusual volcanic events. It's called a mantle plume, where, for reasons that are not entirely understood, lava from inside the earth, sort of, you don't get a volcano like we have now, but you just get this huge sort of outpouring of it's sort of like a hole basically in the mantle, and you get this humongous volcanic event which can last for a very quite a long time, and this one occurred in what's now Siberia, and in much of Siberia is covered, with lava that's basically 250 million years old. It's called the Siberian Traps, is the sort of formation. And the thinking is that is what released all this CO2. But it's hard to get the numbers to add up. I mean, it's not entirely clear even how that could have produced so much CO2. But we, who are, digging up the fossil fuel reserves of the past, so fossil fuels that were laid down over hundreds of millions of years, since the end of the Permian, or in some cases before the end of the Permian, so the Carboniferous, so 300 million year old fossil fuel reserves, and we are burning through them at an amazing rate, so fast that we could go through them all, let's say, in a couple of centuries. That is just an astonishing thing, and that, just when you think about it, would be very, very, very difficult for to happen without human cognition.
I was just reading actually last night about a guy who's the vice president, one of the vice presidents for Kinder Morgan, who, among other things, is wanting to lay pipelines from the tar sands in Alberta to Vancouver, BC, and it's a very contentious issue. And he's he was basically diffusing the accusations about the number of spills they've had on their pipeline, the existing Kinder Morgan pipeline that runs that length right now. But it's interesting that in this interview that he had, he also comes up with saying that he doesn't really believe the climate change is being produced by human beings.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very interesting thing to have somebody who's a spokesperson in the oil industry, who made some very inappropriate comments about comparing the pipeline spills to airplane crashes, and kind of laughing off, well, it was interpreted as laughing off people dying in airplane crashes to diminish the danger of their pipelines. But it seems that I'm wondering how many people who are in those positions in the oil and gas industry actually don't believe or don't want to believe that right. human beings are responsible for what's happening.
Well, I think that it's a very convenient thing to believe, as you're suggesting. I mean, it's interesting that humans. One of the things that we've learned about ourselves is that we're very good at defending ourselves against knowledge that we don't want, and the idea that that you present people with a set of facts and they will just deal with them because people are basically rational is, I think that's been pretty well shot to pieces by now. Saying, so if you're someone who, living depends on building pipelines, then it turns out most people are pretty good at defending themselves against the idea that, okay, this has really destructive impacts. But, all of us, the point that I try to make, when I talk about climate change, I spend a lot of time talking about climate change because the last book I wrote is, we are all implicated here. I mean, if there were not people using that oil, at the end of that pipeline wouldn't get built. So I think that, we have to work on every level of this problem, and none of us, escapes unscathed here.
Yes, I self-flagellate every time I get in my car. I mean, it doesn't help, but it's one of those things where for the last 20 years, I have felt guilty every time I drive. And there was a period in my life when I didn't drive, and I've been trying to figure out, how do I go back there? But I can't do that now. I'm too busy, you know. I'm too...
No, and we let ourselves off the hook in a lot of different ways. And I live out in sort of the country, you know, whatever you want to call it, old farm country. And, you know, it would be very hard to go anywhere without a car. And I totally empathize with everybody who, you know, feels in that position. Now, I also could, you know, I could move. There are all sorts of things that one could do. But I am also even not advocating, you know, that everybody just, you know, sit around feeling dreadfully guilty. I think we all have to sort of try to mobilize what we know and into a better, you know, less carbon intensive world. You know, and I'm you know, going to be frank and say I don't hold out a lot of hope that we're going to do that in the time frame that we have to avoid really, really dreadful impacts. But that would be the sensible and ethically justifiable thing to do.
Well, in your book, which John Stewart said there wasn't anything funny in your book, and you had to agree with that. I think he tried his best to find humor in it. But I was reading along, and I won't call it dismal. It's fascinating, but it's definitely a thought-provoking and very sobering view of what's happening. And then in the last chapter, there's like two paragraphs. You're talking about solutions, and I thought, oh, great, she's found the solutions. And then you debunk it all. So I'm just wondering, what do you take away from this? Because it is really, it's more than sobering. It's kind of an overwhelming reality that we're facing. And how do we move forward and do something that maybe helps the planet to survive with or without us?
Well, I thought long and hard about the end of the book and, you know, what I was going to do at the end there, when people clearly were going to be looking for me to provide the answer that was going to tell them, you know, how we're going to get out of this mess. And I think being a journalist and having sort of a first order obligation to just tell people to the best of my ability what the truth of the matter is, not necessarily what they want to hear or what will even, you know, sell books. I had to say, look, I've laid out a series of ways in which we're changing the world, you know, which we've touched on, some of which we've discussed today, some of which we haven't even talked about yet. And for me to say, okay, here's how we're going to solve all of them so that this, you know, extinction crisis that we're, you know, that has been, as you suggested, also a long time in the making, is that we're going to turn this whole thing around, seems, you know, kind of, whatever I could suggest is not commensurate with the scale of the problem. How's that? So I decided that I wasn't going to do that, and people... Some people, you know, might be annoyed about that, but I think a lot of people appreciated that it didn't take sort of what I'm going to say is the easy way out, because there is no easy way out. And that is really my point. Now, that being said, you know, we are still have many, many choices as a world, you know, as an American society, America as sort of the leader of the global society, we still have a lot of choices to make. To make this problem, end Permian-like scale, or much more minor, and you know, a lot of that will depend on how much of the fossil fuels that are left in the ground we decide to combust, and if we just decide to combust as many as we can possibly get our hands on, you know, then the world is going to look like a very, very different place. In not that long in the future, you know, not in your lifetime, not in my lifetime, but not that long into the future. And I don't think it's going to be a happy place for our descendants. I don't think they're going to judge us kindly. So, and the fact that we do have the ability to, you know, pretty radically reduce our carbon emissions, and we're not doing it, is also, I think, we're going to be judged, you know, very, very harshly for that. So the way forward, I think, is to do the things that we know how to do right now, and that we know would not solve the problem, but would mitigate the problem.
Well, Elizabeth, I really appreciate talking with you. We're unfortunately out of time, but maybe we can continue this conversation at some other point.
Sounds good.
We'll both be working on solutions in the meantime.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Get back to me when you solve this.
I will let you know.
Okay.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining
us.
Okay,
thanks a lot.
And we've been talking this morning with Elizabeth Colbert, who's author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Starting next week, Locus Focus will be on a break while I finish up my latest radio documentary about tar sands. I'll be back on June 7th to premiere the documentary on a special one-hour episode of Locus Focus. And the documentary is called Fighting Goliath. My engineer is Joe Clements. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Sting. Have a very happy summer until I join you again in July. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 14th Annual Village Building Convergence from Friday, May 23rd to Sunday, June 1st. The Village Building Convergence is a 10-day placemaking and urban permaculture festival that leaves a permanent, sustainable impact all across the city as an expression of what communities all across the city are ready to do in their own places. The VBC brings together a vast spectrum of related initiatives, such as community currency, grassroots democracy, ecological design, youth engagement, social justice in action, ecological stewardship, multimodal transportation, and so much more. This year's evening speakers and performers will be at the Sunnyside Methodist Church, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. A list of speakers and more information about